From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Senators are making speeches today for and against Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Tomorrow, they're expected to vote on ending debate, which would move the nomination forward for a full vote, what's called cloture. But enough Democrats have said they won't vote for cloture, they'll filibuster, that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell now says he'll use the nuclear option, change the Senate's rules, so that instead of the 60 votes needed with cloture, only a simple majority of 51 is needed. But it's rarely used because it also removes the filibuster, which leaves the minority party no leverage in the future. This morning on the floor of the Senate, Republican Chuck Grassley blamed that on Democrats.
So at the end of the day, the fact is that if Democrats insist on a filibuster, Republicans will insist on following the practice of that senators have followed for more than 200 years. And that is not to filibuster, have a partisan filibuster for somebody going to the Supreme Court.
In other words, change the rules instead. Senator Chris Coons is a Democrat from Delaware who announced Monday he'd join the Democrats' filibuster, which again triggers the rules change. Senator Coons, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, to the question many are asking, are Democrats making a mistake? Gorsuch is a conservative, replacing the conservative Justice Scalia. The next opening on the court may be a more liberal seat. Justice Ginsburg may retire. Without the Democrats having the filibuster and being in the minority, what leverage do you have to force the Trump administration to possibly make a more moderate choice?
That's a great question, Robin. When the Judiciary Committee met on Monday, I was careful to say that I will join the filibuster unless we can find some way, Republicans and Democrats, to come together and to reach a binding agreement that gives us confidence that the next nominee to the Supreme Court will be more of a consensus pick, where there will be more consensus and more consultation between the president and Democrats and Republicans. That is the long tradition of the Senate. The reason that previous justices haven't been filibustered is that there was more consultation, there was more consensus, and there was frankly more trust between the parties. You just played a quote from Senator Grassley this morning where he suggested that there is a 200-year history of no partisan filibusters against Supreme Court nominees. I don't know what happened over 7 months to prevent Merrick Garland from getting a hearing or getting a vote. But that was nothing if not a partisan filibuster. I know many on the left think this filibuster is a great thing and are celebrating the opposition to Judge Gorsuch. But the reality is, looking forward, we, I think, are going to be looking at a Senate where the ability to work across the aisle, the ability to reach any agreement, and the ability to slow down any future highly partisan Supreme Court nominee will be less and less.
Well, first of all, the Republicans wouldn't say they're breaking the rules. They would say they're changing the rules as is laid out in procedure once they don't get cloture, once, you know, the minority party, in this case the Democrats, vote against cloture, against the straight up and down vote. So they feel they're just going by the procedure that your Democratic vote unlocked. And again, people ask why, given that there is so much to lose for the next vote on a new nominee. And some are saying, I'm looking at Nan Arryn of the Alliance for Justice. She said today in the New York Times, Republicans could abolish the filibuster the next nomination as well. Democrats have nothing to lose. This is about keeping the momentum of your base going. Is that a part of it?
Well, Robin, the key issue that you're highlighting is that if we can't trust each other now, if we simply confirm Judge Gorsuch and trust that they won't break the filibuster on the next nominee, we're in a place where that trust has been badly frayed by the mistreatment of Merrick Garland. We are in a place where both the far right and the left are very engaged, very mobilized. I got thousands of phone calls opposing Judge Gorsuch. I know that Republican colleagues got thousands of phone calls in their offices urging that they take extraordinary measures to make sure they force him out of the court. And that's one of the contributions to this division in the Senate today, is that over the last 30, 40 years, there's been a steady politicization of choices to the Supreme Court. So this is not new.
Well, Senator, we have to let you go, but I want to make sure we're clear. Are you saying that Democrats decided to go this route because there was talk of not going this route, and that Democrats decided to because you didn't get any sense from Republicans that there would be any kind of consultation for the next nominee?
Well, Robin, I can't speak for the whole Democratic caucus. I can speak for myself. Over the last few days, I've met with or spoken to more than a dozen of my colleagues, Republicans and Democrats, trying to craft some sort of an agreement that would allow us to get past this moment and have confidence that the rules would not be broken on the next Supreme Court nominee and that there wouldn't be a filibuster of the next Supreme Court nominee. And we just could not get there.
Chris Coons, the Democratic senator from Delaware, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, less than 2 weeks after it was declared dead, the American Health Care Act is being revived, maybe. Republicans are once again trying to come to a consensus on how to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the talks right now are in the conceptual stages. Let's bring in Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for Vox.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And less than 2 weeks ago, we heard that the Republican health plan, the American Health Care Act, was dead, that there weren't the votes to pass it, that they were tabling any attempts at health care reform and moving on to other issues. What changed?
Yeah, so now this is often referred to as zombie healthcare, where it has kind of risen from the dead and is back in the discussion. I think what changed is Republicans, you know, remembered that this is something they campaigned on for 7 years, that their base really, really cares about. So I don't think there was any actual change in votes. It's not like someone decided, oh, I want to support a different thing. I've changed my views on healthcare. It's more of there's a number of people who are still really committed to trying to see this through and doing more than just the 3 weeks that the American Health Care Act got, that they want to keep working on Obamacare repeal and replace.
Well, who wants it more, the White House or House Republicans?
So I think the White House is definitely driving the train this time. Last time, the American Health Care Act was something that House Speaker Paul Ryan introduced. It was very much an effort led by House leadership. Right now, the two key parties seem to be the White House and the Freedom Caucus, which is the conservative wing of the Republican Party in the House. One thing that's pretty notable about these talks is they seem not to really include House Speaker Ryan in any significant way. It is basically the White House coming to Congress saying, we know you tried this. We know it didn't work. Let's see if we can do a better job of it.
But if they're talking with the Freedom Caucus, then presumably any deal that they come up with is going to be something that the Freedom Caucus is happy with, which would mean that it's probably further to the right than some of the moderates in Congress would be okay with.
Exactly. And this is where things get just as difficult as they did the last time. The White House has also been talking to the Tuesday group, which is a group of more moderate conservatives. And one of the things we've seen evolve just over the past 2 days, really, is that those two groups still want very different things. And even though the White House is talking to both of them, it does not at this point seem to be achieving any sort of consensus that would satisfy the moderate conservatives and the much more conservative House members, which makes me feel like we're really where we were when this whole debate started.
Well, one of the things that we're hearing in the reporting about the negotiations that have been going on Capitol Hill is that Republicans may decide to do something different with the requirement in Obamacare to cover essential health benefits. Do you know more about what they're talking about specifically?
Yeah, so what they've been talking about is Obamacare requires all health insurance companies to cover 10 types of medical care. This includes things like hospital trips and doctor visits and maternity care. One of the things that is really important to the Freedom Caucus is they do not like that requirement. They say, and it is accurate, that it drives up premiums when you require insurance companies to cover more medical care. I think Democrats would say that's okay. We want people to have comprehensive coverage. But the Freedom Caucus says, no, it's making coverage too unaffordable. And they've really said again and again, this is kind of one of our non-negotiables. We need to get rid of this package. One of the things it appears the White House is exploring is possibly giving states waivers out of the essential health benefits, or giving them waivers with a little more flexibility. And the idea is that states that like the health benefits, they could keep them. States that don't could ditch them through a waiver process. So that's one idea that's been floating around, but it still doesn't seem to be quite enough to get all the House Republicans on the same page.
And even if you could get all the House Republicans on the same page, if you put that in the bill, what's going to happen in the Senate?
So that's another excellent question. I think two things will happen in the Senate. One is you'll have a lot of senators balking at that provision. The Senate Republicans tend to be a little more moderate than the House Republicans. The second is it's going to run into procedural issues in the Senate. The House Republicans, the entire Congressional Republican Caucus, want to use a process called reconciliation to move this bill, which means they only need 50 votes. But it also means that anything in the bill has to be directly related to the federal budget. It'll be very hard to make the case that re-regulating health insurance, that telling insurers they do or don't have to cover maternity care, is something directly related to the budget. So there are so many obstacles ahead. Right now, we're all focused on can the House come to an agreement? But even after that, there are some big obstacles out there in the Senate.
Sarah, I just want a one-word answer here. Do you think they're going to be able to vote on this by the end of this week?
No.
Okay.
That was easy.
That was easy. Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for Vox.com. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet with President Trump tomorrow at the president's Palm Beach, Florida resort, Mar-a-Lago. The two aren't expected to golf since the Chinese president doesn't play, but they'll have plenty to talk about, including North Korea. The country conducted its fourth missile test of the year yesterday when it sent a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan. Joining us now is NPR Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn, who's in Beijing. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, how are you, Jeremy?
Doing well. And what are the biggest priorities for President Xi heading into this meeting?
Well, it appears that China wanted this summit the most because they wanted to stabilize ties with Washington. They didn't want these ties spiraling out of control. They want some degree of regularity and predictability to it. I think they would also like assurances that the things that they care about most, which they call core interests, things like Taiwan, Tibet, the South China Sea, that the U.S. will keep its hands off those. And I think those are longer term and more problematic issues.
And what about what President Trump has been saying about China before the election and after the election? Let's listen here to him at a campaign rally in Indiana last year.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country. And that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
Has that harmed the relationship, or is China looking at that and saying, well, that's just what he does? You know, the real core of our relationship is fine.
I think it's dawning here on folks in China that sometimes President Trump's remarks are erratic. You know, they feel whipsawed this way and that sometimes. I think the biggest example from their perspective is Taiwan. First, President Trump suggested he could ditch the one China policy, which requires that the U.S. keep ties with Taiwan unofficial. And then he later calls President Xi Jinping and says they're going to stick to the one China policy. So you can interpret that in different ways. But, you know, China is not averse to cutting deals per se. They have things that they want to give and get too. But I think what they don't want is deals that do not get honored. I don't think it's, you know, they're looking for a grand bargain or anything because they've never really done that before.
Anthony, you're in Beijing. Tell us about the domestic politics at play here, because President Xi is due to get another five-year term in the fall. Does that play into this meeting with President Trump at all?
Of course. It's the main reason that they want stability in the relationship. Xi Jinping is the head of the Communist Party. He's the head of the government, and he's the head of the military. And of course, of all of these, the party is the highest ranking, the most important. So what's going to happen is that this summer and fall, there's going to be a lot of horse trading among the party elites. And then they're going to hold a National Party Congress around October to rubber stamp whatever the elites decide. Now, in Chinese politics, you always get your own house in order before you deal with the guests. So domestic politics is always first priority, and they don't want anything distracting from it, including cutting a deal with Washington in which they appear to have given up too much.
How do the Chinese people view President Trump?
A lot of people wanted Trump to win this the past election, because they see Trump as a businessman. And as I said, they're not averse to doing deals. They think that's a possibility. They also see him as somewhat conceited and vain, and see that as something they can exploit. Also, they see that he has distanced himself from a lot of America's traditional allies, both in the region and around the world. Whether China can capitalize on that is not clear, but China thinks it's good for them, as is the perceived loss of soft power, of moral high ground on a lot of issues such as human rights, such as treatment of ethnic minorities and women, where China feels like it's probably not going to take a lot of criticism from Washington in the Trump years.
That's NPR Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn as we wait for the visit, much anticipated, between Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Trump this week at Trump's Palm Beach, Florida resort Mar-a-Lago. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
And that meeting between President Trump and President Xi was arranged in part by Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, who has a growing list of responsibilities. Kushner is the head of the White House Office of American Innovation, which is tasked with overhauling federal bureaucracy and solving the problem of opioid addiction. He's also responsible for overseeing U.S. relations with China, Canada, and Mexico, and for brokering a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. And on Monday, he went to Iraq for a briefing on the fight against ISIS. Kushner has no experience in government, national security, or international affairs, but he is undoubtedly one of the most important and influential people in President Trump's inner circle. Joining us now is Andrew Rice, who's a contributing editor at New York Magazine. He wrote a cover story on Kushner. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And what is Jared Kushner's expertise exactly?
Well, I mean, he's sort of the son-in-law without portfolio in the administration. I mean, he is an advisor to President Trump. He's said to be the kind of the last person that President Trump talks to before he makes very important decisions. And going into the administration, it was said that he would sort of have free rein to intervene anywhere that the president saw fit. And we're seeing evidence of that in the sheer kind of diversity of things that he's gotten involved with just in the first couple months of the administration.
But give us a little sense of his background. What does he know about? What's he an expert in? What has he done in the past?
He was a real estate developer. He inherited a real estate company from his father, who didn't die but actually went to a federal prison for a rather baroque scandal. And so he was sort of thrown into this position of great responsibility in the family company at a very young age in his early 20s. He also owned a newspaper called the New York Observer that kind of covers the New York City elite. And so he was both sort of a media baron and a real estate player, but really, you know, not anyone who has any experience in policy, foreign policy, or any of the really big matters that he's now involved in.
How did Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump meet?
Well, they originally met. I mean, it's the kind of classic New York tabloid elite meet cute story. They were dating, but they broke up over in part of religious concerns on Jared Kushner's family's part because they are quite Orthodox Jews. And eventually they got back together. The matchmaker was Wendy Deng, the now ex-wife of Rupert Murdoch,
right,
who arranged for them to each independently be invited to the Murdoch yacht, each not knowing that the other was going to be there, and that Rupert and Wendy Deng talked them into getting back together because they thought they were such a good couple.
And did Kushner quickly develop a relationship with Donald Trump? I mean, how did Donald Trump come to trust Jared Kushner as much as he does?
I really think that Jared came into his own and became, you know, a truly kind of integral part of the Trump world, I guess, via the campaign. I mean, he came in and was sort of given smallish tasks to do by Trump. He, by all accounts, performed them well. And as time went on, he became more and more of a power player within that campaign. He was instrumental in the removal, reportedly instrumental in the removal of at least two campaign managers, Corey Lewandowski and Paul Manafort. And I think that's just indicative of his growing influence within Trump's inner circle. And I think that what we've seen so far is that Donald Trump is somebody who values loyalty very highly, and he values family loyalty much higher than any other form of loyalty. And Kushner has shown, if nothing else, that he's intensely loyal to Donald Trump.
Would you call Jared Kushner a foreign policy hawk or dove?
Well, I mean, I think the only area in which it's really truly possible to say definitively is on Israel. He's very much in lockstep, I think, with Netanyahu. He's somebody who really supports the government of Israel right down the line. On other things, say, for instance, China and other matters, I think there is some evidence to suggest that Kushner is a less hardline figure than somebody like Steve Bannon, with whom he has had a cooperative relationship during the campaign, and there have been reports that there's more tension between them now. But I think it's quite difficult to kind of talk about a worldview of Jared Kushner, because really I think his worldview is basically trying to put into action Donald Trump's policies or Donald Trump's ideology. He's really about kind of fulfilling the Trump agenda, such as it is, more than advancing any particular ideology.
And do you get the sense that he's a true believer in the Trump agenda?
I think he's a true believer in Trump. I think the agenda is really whatever Trump happens to be enunciating at any given time. And I think Jared would probably be perfectly comfortable if the president decided that he wanted to tack back towards the center and do some things on infrastructure, which Jared is very much in favor of, if he were to try to do some things on education, tax reform, that a relatively moderate tax reform that the Gary Cohn of Goldman Sachs is quite close to Jared has been advocating. I think that's sort of where Jared's beliefs lie. But I think ultimately he's going to do whatever it is that Donald Trump wants.
That's Andrew Rice, who is a contributing editor for New York Magazine. We'll link you to his story about Jared Kushner at hereandnow.org. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks so much.
A new report from the New York Federal Reserve Bank finds that student loan debt may be preventing people from buying homes. This comes as student debt has more than doubled in the last 10 years to $1.3 trillion. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, tell us about this report about how much student loan debt is impacting home buying.
Well, look, there are a couple things to consider here. Student loan debt is much higher than it has been. It's actually doubled, as you mentioned, in the past decade. But that's, you know, in part because more Americans are going to college and more Americans are getting loans. The issue is that a small percentage of borrowers, student borrowers, have in excess of $100,000 in debt after they graduate. And the problem is that is affecting their ability to buy homes. It's actually affecting their ability on a number of fronts. So while, generally speaking, a college education guarantees you a better income, in some cases people are either not getting that income or they're out of work at the moment and they're defaulting on their loans, ruining their credit, and not being able to buy homes.
And does that have an effect on the housing market, a big effect on the housing market, to not have these people probably in their 20s and their 30s going out and buying homes the way that I guess they would have in the past?
Yeah, it's a huge effect because we have really, since the 50s, relied upon what we call a replacement effect. The idea that as older people pass on or move out of their homes into assisted living or retirement homes, there's always someone else available to buy that home. And when you don't have younger people coming in to be able to do that, it will ultimately depress the price of homes. Now, against that, we have high immigration rates, so there are people coming in to buy those homes. But fundamentally, this concept of a replacement unemployment rate is being affected by the fact that the normal course of events where you go to college, you get a good job, and you buy a home, well, that last part is being slowed down by the degree to which people are graduating with high debt.
All right, well, let's go back to that headline number that student loan debt has more than doubled in the last 10 years. Give us a sense of what's going on with student loan debt. How could it possibly go up that much in 10 years?
Well, borrowers on average leave school. They graduate from university owing about $34,000. That is 70% more than it was a decade ago. And that's because education costs are one of those areas that have grown at a rate that's much, much higher than inflation. That's been going on for some time. It's an unintended consequence of the government guaranteeing the fact that if you qualify for school, you'll get some kind of loan. So colleges know that they can actually charge more for tuition because someone will pay it. But guaranteeing that students are going to get a loan doesn't necessarily mean that you're guaranteeing them a good future. You're just guaranteeing that they'll graduate with a lot of debt, and you hope that when they get the job that they qualified for, it'll allow them to pay that debt down. In some cases, that's just not happening.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there's been a lot coming out of the Trump administration, but I don't think we've gotten a plan for how to deal with student loan debt yet.
We haven't. During the election, that was something that was floated by both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. But no, we've not addressed this. This is a complicated issue, and it really comes down to whether or not the government should continue to guarantee that no matter where tuition rates go, people will be able to get loans for them, or whether the government can take some role in trying to control the spiraling costs of education. That's part of the problem as well.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
In a memo this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions directed the Justice Department to review federal agreements made under the Obama Justice Department with dozens of law enforcement agencies across the country. Basically, the memo said, ensure that the acts of a few bad actor cops don't impugn the work police officers do to keep communities safe. But many of those decrees were put in place after the Obama administration found police department-wide problems, like African Americans disproportionately stopped or fined to create a revenue stream. And many of the consent decrees came after protests leapt out of the Black Lives Matter movement in response to the shooting deaths of unarmed black men by police. Now there's some grumbling from BLM supporters. Where is the movement? And will Black Lives Matter be there if these decrees are rolled back? Peniel Joseph is founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He wrote a cover story for this month's New Republic titled, Why Black Lives Matter Still Matters. Peniel, Professor Joseph, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And let's get some context first. The Black Lives Matter movement originated from that hashtag created in 2013 after Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman fatally shot Trayvon Martin, the teenager walking in his father's neighborhood. But the movement took on a bigger life after shootings in Ferguson and Baltimore. What can we compare Black Lives Matter to? We've got a civil rights movement with Martin Luther King. We've got a Black Power movement with Stokely Carmichael and others. Where does it fit in?
Well, I think it straddles really both movements, but it's more comparable to Black Power than civil rights, Robin. And that's primarily because the BLM movement has a structural criticism of racism. So they're not just criticizing the justice system. They're making a claim that the justice system in the United States is connected to unemployment, public school segregation, environmental racism and inequality. So it's just basically the police are the tip of a larger iceberg of systemic oppression. And what makes them so interesting is this notion of intersectionality. The three co-founders of that hashtag were all black women, feminist and queer identified. And when we think about BLM, they're really the first movement coming out of that civil rights, black power, black liberation struggle that places gender, sexuality, youth, poverty at the core of that movement for social change.
Well, and there was a lot of criticism of the Black Power movement, in particular Black Panthers, that they often weren't as respectful of women.
Absolutely. The Panthers and the wider Black Power movement, and when we think about civil rights as well, deeply implicated in systems of patriarchy and sexism and misogyny against women. With that being said, Black women were also key organizers of both the civil rights protest and also Black Power. Here, with BLM being so decentralized, you've had Black women share the spotlight and take the lead in terms of both organizing the actions and disruptions of the BLM. So it's really a change for the better, I would argue, when you have Black women at the forefront of the leadership, but also when we think about the theoretical foundations of the leadership, they're thinking about Black women being head of single parent households in the United States. They're thinking about Black women and rates of incarceration, the wealth gap between Black and white women and the income gap, which is very important because Black women are the major voters within the African-American community. They're the major breadwinners. They're the major people who raise the young Black boys and young Black men who are often victims of police violence.
So you're making the point that as the Black rights movement, really, the civil rights and Black rights movement grew in the 60s, it included and led to SNCC, the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee, founded by Blacks and whites. But how, you know, make the case again, how is BLM, Black Lives Movement Now, tell us more about how it's more like Black Power than Martin Luther King.
Well, King is initially a reformer, Robin, and he becomes a political revolutionary. And in a way, except for adhering to nonviolence, he really starts to have a structural criticism against Vietnam, militarism, racism, human rights violations. When we think about the BLM movement, they're both taking the civil disobedience tactic nonviolently from that civil rights struggle, but they're ratcheting it up by calling for a systematic wide change. And their tactics have also been very disruptive in line with the Black Power period. When we think about them shutting down highways, some people were very supportive of that, but it's to the chagrin of others. There were Black Lives Matter rallies that were disrupting the status quo on college campuses. They were even disrupting people's brunch in New York City and other places.
What? Heavens.
To the chagrin of many yuppies and buppies and elites of all stripes. So when we think about the BLM, it's really about both that structural critique and the robust in-your-face tactics that they're using.
But they also, well, they don't have a leader. They don't have a Malcolm X. They don't have a Martin Luther King. They don't have the people who had become famous for, you know, being some of the leaders of the Black Panthers. How does that fit in?
Well, that's a good thing. And they're very similar to civil rights organizing vis-a-vis the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which you just mentioned. Their nickname was SNCC. And when we think about SNCC, we associate them by 1966 with Stokely Carmichael and the Call for Black Power. But initially, they're founded by Ella Jo Baker, who's an activist from North Carolina, a feminist, a trade unionist, and really one of the most important organizers of the 1960s. And she tells the young people not to be hijacked or come under the thumb of any of the older leadership, even though Ella Baker is around 60 at this time. She's making an argument that decentralized leadership is better than having one central political mobilizer like King, who the movement sort of rises and falls with. So when we think about the BLM movement, what's so great about the dozens of chapters that they have is that there isn't one person who's leading all of this. Now, that makes it harder for media to identify and set up neat narratives with the movement. But I think it means that the movement's going to be much longer lasting because we have people actually doing work and organizing, and it's not a top-down hierarchical leadership structure.
By the way, with SNCC, you also had Bob Moses, people like him. People should Google him.
Possibly. Absolutely, and he's a Cambridge native. Moses is brilliant, incredible.
Yeah. Well, but some people might say that today, not having this leadership, you know, they might wonder, why is that a good thing, especially when this is a new environment? You have Attorney General Sessions, who credits Scott King, actually begged lawmakers not to affirm him for a federal judgeship decades ago because of his racist comments decades ago. He fought civil rights activists. He tried to prosecute activists who were trying to register voters. So this is who is the now sitting attorney general. Some might say we can't have an amorphous movement here. We need something with more spine.
And we've seen that through BLM and the Movement for Black Lives policy agenda that was published last summer. And it talked about ending the war against Black people, divesting from criminal justice institutions that incarcerate and lead to mass incarceration, and investing in Black youth and neighborhoods and communities. And I would say we do have several young activists who people know who they are, including Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, DeRay McKesson, and others who are organizing, and young people know who they are. But it's just not the kind of top-down celebrity culture that we saw in the context of the 1960s and 70s. And remember, that also, it didn't work. I mean, very, very famous people didn't lead to the kind of substantive transformation that people had hoped for, because if it had, we wouldn't have the need for a BLM movement 50 years later in 2017.
Yeah, no matter how much Harry Belafonte tried. Well, Benil, we began by talking about Attorney General Sessions' review of these federal consent decrees made between the Justice Department and some cities. But what do you say to people who say, look, the pendulum swung a little too far? We do need to send the message that in addition to ferreting out the bad apples in police departments, we have to have government standing up for these men in blue who risk their lives to patrol the streets.
Well, I'd say that that's exactly the wrong perspective, because what the BLM movement really illustrated, the depth and breadth of structural racism and state violence through law enforcement against African-American, against Latino, and at times poor white communities in the United States. So if anything, we need dramatic and radical reform that actually goes beyond what Obama's Justice Department politically could achieve. We have to change and transform this whole society. And in that way, Robin, they do go back to Dr. King, and when King talked about a bitter and beautiful struggle for social and political change.
That's Peniel Joseph talking about the cover story for this month's New Republic, Why Black Lives Matter Still Matters. Peniel, Professor Joseph, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
By the way, I said men. It's, of course, men and women in blue. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org, where we'd love your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement, where it stands now as well.
1 in 7 Americans is now 65 or older, and that number is increasing. So it will come as no surprise that senior housing is a growing industry in many parts of the country. There are nearly 2,500 senior housing properties in the U.S. That's according to the National Investment Center for Senior Housing and Care. And as Kathy Ritchie of Here and Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports, there's more to building these communities than just brick and mortar.
It's moving day at Morningstar Assisted Living and Memory Care in Fountain Hills, Arizona, just east of Phoenix. Crews carry in furniture and piece together side tables while designers review plans to figure out what will fit where.
Like a cocktail table over here.
This new facility is the brainchild of Luann Tomaholic, the owner of Tomaholic Designs. She describes her company as a senior-centric design firm.
That's all we do. And there's certainly competition in other design firms that do senior housing, but they also do other things. They do hotels, or they do multifamily development, or restaurants, or residential. Oh, yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Tomaholic says this project is just one of 47 that she and her team are working on nationwide, each with a similar focus.
When we design, it's a combination of healthcare, hospitality.
So there's a cafe, a restaurant, a theater room, and a beauty salon.
All the amenities that help them to socialize, but then it still has to feel like home in certain areas and be comfortable for the residents.
Everything is custom ordered, like the wing chairs used in several seating areas.
Everything has to have arms and a certain arm height so that the resident can get in and out of the chair easily. And we do our cushions extremely hard. To us, it almost feels uncomfortable, but it gives a firmness that, again, assists the resident being able to get out of the chair.
For Tomaholic, every detail, no matter how mundane, matters, including the lighting.
Because as we age, there's so much macular degeneration, and the light levels have to increase without having glare.
And the color of the carpet, which can't go beyond an 80% change in brightness or shade. That's because if a resident has challenges with their memory, says Tomaholic, a dramatic color difference could be perceived as a hole in the floor or a height change.
It's easy to have residents move in, but if they're not thriving in that space, or if they don't have a purpose in that space, then we've failed in terms of our design.
Needless to say, business is steady. In central Phoenix, a group of construction workers are jackhammering trenches at a dusty worksite. Brendan Morrow is with Drive Development Partners, a real estate firm that develops senior housing.
There are literally thousands of units a year coming online in the Phoenix market, and I don't see that stopping for the next probably 3 years at a minimum.
Morrow says most of the projects are geared toward a certain population.
You do see the majority of developments chasing the top 5% of income levels. And then you have some that are chasing the, you know, the top 1%.
But Morrow's not one of those developers. This project is an affordable senior housing community geared toward veterans. And the key word here is affordable. Not exactly a buzzword among most developers. And that, says Mark Stapp, could be a big problem.
If you have somebody who's on fixed income and you're looking at monthly expenses of $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 a month, depending on the level of care you need, you realize you quickly run out of resources.
Stapp is the executive director of the Masters of Real Estate Development Program at Arizona State University. He says an aging population, like the baby boomers, faces a triple threat: inadequate income, declining health and mobility, along with growing isolation. Still, with 10,000 people turning 65 every day,
it doesn't take a lot of math to figure out that we have a growing demand for both spaces and services.
Stapp says the reality is we're living longer, and the percentage of people who will need resources like trained caregivers and affordable housing is only going to grow.
Because it's not just building the units. It's building the right units in the right location with the right systems and the right support, both financial and otherwise.
But with so much uncertainty when it comes to Medicare and the fate of the Affordable Care Act, Stapp doesn't think the policies are in place yet, even at the local level, to address what is sometimes called the silver tsunami. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie.
So as we just heard there, along with a growing demand for affordable housing, social isolation continues to be a challenge for seniors. And in Ohio, a new pilot program aims to help with that. The Ohio State University has launched Give Back, Go Forward, an initiative where people age 60 or older who live in and around Columbus can volunteer to earn college tuition. Seniors sign up to complete 100 hours of community service over the span of a year. In exchange, they earn a tuition voucher for 3 undergraduate credit hours. Mm. That's equal to about 1 class at Ohio State, which on average costs about $1,000. Seniors who volunteer can use the course credits for their own education or give away their vouchers to their grandchildren or someone else in need as long as they live in state.
Hmm. That's something. Give
Great
it,
idea.
Yeah, give it away.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.